From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
The Mission.
Excelsior.
Redwood City.
American Canyon.
San Francisco.
Vallejo.
I'm from Redwood City, so I guess that's in the peninsula.
Coming up, we delve into the good, the bad, and the ugly of the Bay Bridge.
You know, you just don't know how it is that things happened when the dust got settled here. I mean, some things apparently had no quality control at all.
A conversation with Chronicle reporter Jackson Vanderbecken. Then we go to Burlingame, where local artists have a new home for their work.
The hand of the artist is there. The heart and soul, if it's good work, is there. And you can feel that when you're in the room.
Meet the woman behind the new Peninsula Museum of Art. And what's this sound? This week's mystery sound coming up today on Cross Currents. America's economic recession had an effect on all industries, including the food industry. The USDA reports that during the recession from 2007 to 2009, we all spent less on groceries, we ate at home more, and went out to eat less. Back in 2009, we checked in with Le Cheval restaurant in Oakland to see how they were handling the downturn. Le Cheval is a big downtown restaurant with one large room and high ceiling. The whole place can seat nearly 300 when it's full. And according to manager Min Tran, it was frequently full. But in 2010, Le Cheval was forced to leave its spacious location because the building's owner was approaching foreclosure on the property, a spot the restaurant had occupied for 16 years. Tran says those times were tough. Le Cheval moved to a smaller location down the block and kept running under a different name, LCX. It's since returned to its original space under its original name. Reporter Sarah Reynolds went to Le Cheval to talk with Min Tran about how things have shifted for the restaurant over the last couple of years.
I believe we lost a lot of customers because we moved in on top of that recession. So it's kind of double whammy for us. Yeah. I'm doing my best just to promote our restaurant, our brand, to bring back customers back to this location. Thanks to social network, and it's a little bit inexpensive than advertising. So. There used to be more party, more birthdays and gathering and family get together, and it seemed it's less now than before, more than 50%. One side of the restaurant is mostly for banquet and parties, and it used to fill up almost every night. I think it's just gonna take time. You got to hang on, like every business. We have good time and bad time. For us here, it's about passion. If you have to like food and you have to like people. And if you don't have it, don't get into this kind of business. This is not something to make you to be super rich about. But you know, every day we hear customers say, "Oh my God, you're back." And that's just good to hear.
After 28 years, Min Tran is kind of used to these dips in business, but he says they're never easy to take. What restaurants in your neighborhoods have changed since the recession? Let us know on our Facebook page, KALW. And you can check out Le Cheval for yourself at 1007 Clay Street in Oakland. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We'll now turn to the region's biggest budget project, the Eastern Span of the Bay Bridge. Plans for this seismically strong segment were first developed in 2002. Since then, it's been more than a decade, and the single suspension structure has cost more than $6 billion. It's overdue and over budget, and recent issues involving snapping rods and improperly galvanized bolts may delay the long-awaited Labor Day opening. San Francisco Chronicle reporter Jackson Vanderbecken has been covering the Bay Bridge controversies. KALW's Ben Trefney sat down with him for a wide-ranging conversation. He started by asking whether Caltrans has been upfront about why there have been so many problems.
Well, they've released some material about it, and they think they've answered what questions they have been able to date. I don't think we have all the information about what they did or what they didn't do. I think we have a version of events that sort of puzzles a lot of people.
Well, that said, do you get the impression that they're being as transparent as they could as they do their own research into what's happened?
Well, I mean, I think there have been people who've been critical of that. There have been some documents that have been released. Is it a complete record of the documents? Based on what I know, I don't think it is. I think that there may be more documents forthcoming. We'll see. In the meantime, Caltrans has to make some decisions about whether it's going to open the bridge as scheduled over Labor Day weekend. And on July 10th, they say they should have that question answer, whether they're going to be making the deadline, whether they will have resolved a number of these issues about how they chose these rods on anchors and bolts. I don't know whether that is ever going to be satisfactorily answered.
Well, since that deadline is something that people have their eye on quite a lot, and the July 10th decision about Labor Day weekend, what are the costs and benefits versus risks on opening it then or not? I mean, obviously, from a safety standpoint, you just want to make sure, you know, they've done all due diligence, but there is also the rush to get the thing done.
Well, Steve Heminger, who's the executive director of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, spoke about that at some length at their recent meeting, and he basically said that if they don't make the Labor Day opening, you know, all bets are essentially off. They don't know how long it might be. It could be well into next year before they find a suitable time frame to open the bridge while traffic is low. They're not going to do it during the holiday season, so they seem to be hard set on making this deadline if they can, although they say that safety is a critical issue and they won't open the bridge unless it's safe. How that's measured, and there's two questions. What they do now, I think as they go forward, they could theoretically open the bridge and start replacing some of the harder copies of these anchors and rods and bolts. The only thing that's really delaying the bridge opening is whether they can put together this fix for the 32 rods that failed of the first 96 that they installed back in 2008 that were tightened in March of this year. 32 failed. So they're throwing out all those rods, not literally because they're keeping them in many of them in place, but they're not using them to anchor this seismic shear key, which is supposed to resist seismic forces. And it's bolted in at a high level of tension to keep it from moving. And so the bridge operates as a unit and it doesn't literally fall off its supports. So that has to be, they have engineered a solution involving basically strapping down what they call a saddle. It's like a brace. It's essentially it's a supplement to the rods, which are basically being, you know, discounted as being worthless at this point. Mm-hmm. And so they've reduced the tension on those rods anyway for whatever reason. So they basically have given up on them. And so now they have to figure this method out. And once they get it in place, the contractor will be able to tell them whether to be able to get it done. If they can't get it done by Labor Day, they're not going to get the bridge done by Labor Day. So that's really the governing factor, whether the contractor tells them that they can meet the schedule. And then, of course, that nothing goes wrong. And that's not been the pattern on this bridge. Things go wrong. So between now and Labor Day, virtually everything will have to go right for Caltrans for them to make that date.
That's Jackson Vanderbecken. He's a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. There are a lot of bridges around the Bay Area, and there's a lot of huge projects around the world. I'm wondering, are the problems that are coming up with this one, and the cost overruns for that matter, are these unique to the situation, or are these different kind of obstacles that are often overcome when you're dealing with a major infrastructure project?
Well, I think it's a little of both. This is a unique situation in that this is a unique bridge. It's a kind of a self-anchored suspension span of its type has not been built before to withstand the earthquake forces that are envisioned, the most probable quake that could occur in a 1,500-year cycle. So it's a big demand, and there's a lot of leaps that were taken in making this bridge.
How big, incidentally, would that quake be in a 1,500-year cycle?
Well, I think it's going to be, you know, over close to 8 or above. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the exact seismic forces, you know, how they work. I mean, there's so many different variables. You know, seismic forces can work. For example, in the Loma Prieta quake, the bridge, the old bridge, survived because it was relatively short in duration. Whereas this bridge, they have to model all sorts of forces to come up with, you know, the worst combination thereof, the most accelerated forces across a number of spectrums, just sort of like the worst of the worst. And they're using a probabilistic model instead of just like thinking of like what's the worst earthquake that anyone can envision. They work up a model that says this is the worst earthquake that is probable over a 1,500-year period. As Caltrans officials point out, most bridges, even if they're made earthquake resistant, are just meant to survive the quake, not fall down. This is a bridge that's made to be operational within, you know, 24 or 48 hours. It takes a lot of engineering to weigh. They have a lot of things that have to be calculated, and they have to make things that are made to break, literally. They're sacrificial, so to speak, in this bridge to handle the forces. The tower, for example, has these connectors that are not made so much that they would ultimately not fail. They're basically made to fail and hold the tower together as a unit. So they've done a lot of things that they understand, you know, would end up having to be replaced or modified. These bolts, however, a number of the rods and bolts cannot be replaced. They're either at the bottom of the tower, and they can't lift the tower up to get them out. Otherwise, they've only removed one, and they had to cut it up in 6-foot segments to do it. Then there's smaller bolts that are actually holding together seismic stabilization bearings. They're big triangular, like teeter-totter-like things that work to distribute the forces in a quake. They're bolted together, and they can't take them apart. They're sandwiched between the road deck and the concrete pillar below that sits atop the column. Now they're going to have to arguably live with them because they can't take that material out. You know, it seems kind of odd, but Caltrans is having to grapple with something, having surmounted many engineering challenges to make this bridge. You know, the joke is that the bolts are kind of the dumb end of this operation. You know, it doesn't, I mean, this was not a particularly, I mean, if anybody had consulted a single industry standard manual, contacted the Federal Highway Administration, read a DOT study that dates to 1991, they would have all seen that this is no way to build a bridge.
That's San Francisco Chronicle reporter Jackson Vanderbecken speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can find more of their conversation with many more details about exactly what's going wrong and right with the Bay Bridge construction at our website, KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now let's follow San Francisco's Embarcadero a bit north to Crissy Field, where the fate of the old military commissary building is being debated. 2 weeks from now, on June 17th, the public will get a chance to comment on the proposals that the Presidio Trust is considering for the space. Star Wars creator George Lucas is among the finalists with a proposal for a museum celebrating outstanding American illustrators like Maxfield Parrish and Norman Rockwell. Lucas would supply most of the artwork from his personal collection. And that's a common creation story for museums, according to local sculptor and art instructor Ruth Waters.
Generally, an art museum comes out of the collection and the wealth of a private collector who needs a place to put his stuff and wants to share it with the community. We didn't start that way.
When Waters says we, she's talking about the Peninsula Museum of Art in Burlingame. It's one of the Bay Area's newest museums, and Waters is the creative mind behind it. She's not a wealthy collector or a philanthropist. She's a working artist. KALW's Stephen Short paid Ruth Waters a visit to see how this unlikely museum founder finally made her dream a reality.
And welcome to the Peninsula Museum of Art. You can crawl past the equipment.
This doesn't sound like what I would expect a museum to sound like. What's going on here?
Well, we're moving into the electronic age, and what's being installed now is a keypad so that when our volunteers arrive in the morning, they can punch in a code and get in. And I don't have to be here every minute to open the door. So, sounds like progress to me.
Ruth Waters isn't kidding when she says that she's been here every minute. She is the spark and flame behind the Peninsula Museum of Art. And as you can hear, it's still a work in progress. Now, even wealthy philanthropists with ready-made collections run into setbacks when trying to develop museums. So it's not surprising to find that the start of this project goes way back. How far back?
Well, I found my first art center building in 1977 in Belmont.
She conceived of that art center to be both an open studio and a gallery. It was modeled on a center she was part of as an artist in Alexandria, Virginia. She made sculptures there for a couple of years before she and her family returned to the Bay Area in the late 1970s. When she proposed starting a museum based on that dual gallery-studio model right here on the peninsula, there wasn't much interest. Who needs another art museum when nearby San Francisco already has so many? But Ruth Waters stuck to her vision.
I saw the benefits to the artists and to the community of creating a public venue where artists had good workspace and the public was welcome to come in and watch.
And things had changed after the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989. Transportation issues made it a little more difficult to get to the city, and for the first time, Peninsula residents started looking for ways to cultivate their own culture. Waters remembers a decisive meeting in 1997, that's 20 years after she started, where civic leaders and residents at San Mateo City Hall considered the issue.
And by the middle of the afternoon, it had become very clear with the speeches and the discussions and the questions from the floor and all the rest that there were two major holes in the cultural fabric of the county. One was the lack of a real performing arts center, and the other was the lack of an art museum.
Bingo. Finally, she had her chance. Waters started small, working with a board of supporters to create a version of her dream museum in 2004. It was housed in a historic mansion in Belmont. More recently, starting in 2011, they spent 2 years looking for bigger buildings.
All up and down the peninsula. And buildings that would work for the museum, because they had internal space and high ceilings, generally had no way of adapting to the needs of the art studios.
Early this year, work began on the transformation of this 18,000-square-foot space in Burlingame to fit her plan. Ruth Waters says there's no substitute for the face-to-face experience visitors can now have with artwork here.
Looking at a picture in a book doesn't do it. It's a teaser. The actual artwork of wonderful paintings and sculpture, the hand of the artist is there. The heart and soul, if it's good work, is there. And that communicates. It reaches out to people. It has a power that a reproduction just doesn't have. And you can feel that when you're in the room.
You can even smell it. I can smell the paint in here.
That paint smell, by the way, is from the construction work, not the paintings. Nearly every wall of this complex is new. But walk into the section where the artist studios are, and visitors might indeed smell paint. There are 33 studios in all, and the interaction with the public is going just as Waters planned.
I can't tell you how many times families have come wandering in on a Sunday afternoon or whatever, and then the kids will run out and say, "Oh, Mommy, I just met a real artist." And that, I think that is just terribly important, to bring the creative people, the visual artists, out of isolation, out of the corner of the basement or the kitchen or wherever, and into the community. We need each other.
My name's Wayne Wickern, and I am finding the space to be quite brilliant for me.
Wayne Wickern is a good example of this need for community. This Redwood City artist makes custom hats. One of his creations was worn at this year's Kentucky Derby. Yes, that kind of hat. Wickern was working out of his garage before he moved into his new studio at the museum.
Working in sort of isolation has not been as productive in the last 3 or 4 years for me as I would have liked it to have been. So just hearing noise in the other part of the place, looking across the courtyard here and seeing people in the museum has sort of energized me, and I expect it to further energize me.
Admission to the museum is free, and income from the studio rentals goes a long way in helping with that. All of the workspaces are currently spoken for. It has taken over a generation for Waters to fulfill this dream of a regional art complex. So now that it's fully operational, what's next? Could it possibly be time for Waters to retire?
Oh, that's what my husband keeps saying. My kids will say, why do you need all that stress? Why don't you retire? I don't retire.
Instead, she talks about nourishing this new cultural destination so that it, in turn, can nourish artists who will inspire visitors for many years to come. At the Peninsula Museum of Art in Burlingame, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
The silk screens of the legendary Joe Price will be on display at the Peninsula Museum of Art until July 14th. The Art of Science Fiction opens this weekend, June 9th, and the museum also has a goth art show planned for the fall. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for
the sound thing.
The sound friend thing.
The soundscape game.
And the sound heard to recognize the neighborhood.
And there was a sound of the day just played on KLW.
The sound I just heard of San Francisco was
audio sound and for this week.
Your audio file for this week.
The sound bite thingy that you just had on.
It's the audio print.
Audiograph. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound. We asked you what you think it is and where in the Bay Area it's from. We sent KALW's Dora Finkelstein to bring us this week's answer.
Welcome to the Pacific Pinball Museum of Alameda, California. My name is Dan Fonts.
What brought you to the Pinball Museum today?
I work here. I've played pinball since I was a kid. Pinball used to be in hardware stores, and it was everywhere. It was in barber shops and grocery stores, and today you don't see it there that much. But at one point, pinball brought in more money, like in the 50s up through the 1970s, brought in more money than the entire movie industry. A quarter at a time. Yeah, that's how big of a part of the culture it was.
Do you have a favorite game?
Oh, sure. Team One. Gottlieb's Team Run, right there. I get to watch people play it all day. And most people don't know how to play it very well. And a few expert players come in here who are some of the best players in the world. And we watch the score just go way, way up into the stratosphere. A lot of fun.
Got a lot of calls on this one, but there's only one winner, and that is John Wawona, who celebrated his birthday there. And he says his favorite game is the Silver Surfer. Congratulations, John. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, there will be another contest next week. So in the meantime, go to KALW.org to hear more from Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. And that does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Lisa Carmack, Leela Day, Ben DeLuca, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Dora Finkelstein, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daphne Matsiaraki, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. The music you're hearing now is by the Zofo Duet. That's four hands playing one piano. Zofo received two Grammy nominations this year for their first album titled Mind Meld. You can see the Bay Area musicians perform on Sunday afternoon at the Center for New Music on Taylor Street in San Francisco. Show starts at 5 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.